Welcome to Real Talk JavaScript, the weekly talk show with advice and insight into the technologies and practices currently being used to build web applications in the real world. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallen, and John Papa talk to industry experts about their experiences writing, deploying, and maintaining web applications in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome back to Real Talk JavaScript. This is episode 51, Building Software Without Frameworks. And today, our guest is Niall Crosby. And I've got my hosts on. I've got a full quorum, Ward Bell and Dan Wallen. How you both doing?
Fantastic.
Oh, am I muted? No.
Yeah, Dan.
I'm kidding. We do that all the time, so I had to pause.
Oh, my gosh. Dan, how are you? Sleeping?
I'm doing phenomenal. I purposely paused. I have to admit, John lately likes to, we'll get on a call and he'll be like, Dan, I can't hear you. And I'll be like, really? You can't hear me? No, Dan, I can't hear you. And he can hear me. So I'm just paying back. That's all.
It's called great dad jokes. Dad jokes are just the best jokes ever out there. You know, only thing better than dad jokes are mom jokes, by the way. So Ward, you've had some interesting weeks behind you here. You've done some cool stuff lately.
Yeah, well,
you?
I'm growing a beard because I just got off the river floating down the Grand Canyon, the Colorado. Actually, you don't float down the Grand Canyon. You float down the Colorado.
That would be weird.
It would be harsh. floating down the Colorado through
nice.
The 270
that
miles
fun.
Through the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, at first I was imagining you in like a parachute or parasail, like floating down the Colorado, the Grand Canyon.
That could be our quick one-way trip.
That must have been beautiful and just absolutely amazing.
It is astonishing. If you haven't been to America's Grand Canyon, it definitely has to move up the bucket list. And I have to say that this was very cush because it was a whole bunch of people involved and they had different abilities and everybody's terrified of these very big rapids. So on these boats, which are motor driven, you get the thrills without the spills. And you eat too well or too much anyway, or both. But it was a great time and the stars are, amazing. The geology is amazing. You get a complete geology lesson from beginning to end.
So was this like a guided tour that you had? It sounds like,
yeah,
I like those kind of things. Yeah.
I would say there's nothing, many people are afraid. In fact, we had a couple people drop out cause they got too spooked. But it was all thrills with no real risk. The captains are very skilled. I have hiked from rim to rim. So that was a hiking trip and that gives you like one slice, vertical slice of it. But when you go the length of it, you see the evolution of the West and it's really, really amazing. Highly recommended.
That's fascinating, and it brings us to today's sponsor, which is Colorado River Rapid Tours in the Grand Canyon with Ward Bell. Just sign up right here, and Ward will take you on. I'm just kidding, everybody. I'm kidding.
I'm going to put a link to the company that took me down there.
You should absolutely do that. I'd love that's one of those things on my bucket list.
I live in Arizona,
there, as you know. So
it is.
Yeah, it's right in your backyard, dude.
Exactly. What is your excuse, Dan? Come on.
That's boring stuff. We do more fun things. No, I do want to do that.
That would be a lot of fun. And today we have a guest on our show, Niall Crosby. How you doing, Niall?
Hello, guys. Delighted to be here.
It's very good to have you. And Niall, you are a frequenter of the ngConf and other Angular events, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. We've been going to Angular Connect and ngConf for about 5 years now. First a speaker, and then we started doing sponsorships, and it was brilliant. Last year at ngConf, we were the premier sponsor, which we were just thrilled about.
Yeah, I saw that. And let me just get our listeners acquainted with you. I'll read your bio real quick. Niall's the CTO and CEO of AG Grid, the popular JavaScript data grid, a native of Ireland with computer science degree. He's worked as a full stack developer for 20 years using mostly Java. We won't hold that against you. The idea of AG Grid came as Niall was working with the investment banks in London. I got frustrated with his investments. No, I'm kidding. With the grid choice available in JavaScript. So he started AG Grid as an open source project. The grid was so successful that he quit his job to work full time on AG Grid. Today, AG Grid is a London-based company with 20 employees, thousands of customers, millions of downloads. and it's a major component with hundreds of thousands of enterprise applications globally. So Niall, this is like, it sounds like this is your passion, this is your dream, and you're getting to live it. Am I off base here?
Absolutely. It's not often that somebody can start an open source project and then stay with that project and start working on it full time. Because one of the problems with open source is you're trying to do it in your spare time or evenings and weekends, and it's in conflict. And to be able to just say, quit my job and work on this, it's been great.
That sounds like a lot of fun. And so one of the things we talked about, just so all the listeners know, is when we pre-screen our guests for the calls, the one thing we really drive through is we don't want to have like a product endorsement as our whole episode, right? This is more about, you know, building real world applications and centered around JavaScript, obviously, thus the title. And when we were talking about this, you and I had a real good idea that this, while the topic is AG Grid, it's really more about what fascinated me was how you came to create this, what problem you found, how you solved it, and some of the challenges that you overcame. So do you want to kind of just lead us into that topic and tell us about, like, what is this thing and what was the problem it solved?
The problem it solved was being able to provide me with a data grid that I needed when I was building these financial applications, because what was out there didn't really do what we needed it to do, which was to have a lot of data and then have those data grid features such as pinning, sorting, filtering, grouping. And we just needed something that was better than what was already in the market. And I come from a Java background, so I was used to what was available in the Java enterprise space, and that's really what I wanted. So I started AG Grid as a pet project, just purely for myself, to see, could I do something that I could use in my work? And I released AG Grid as open source, and a community gathered around AG Grid, and I realized, hey, the problems that I had, they weren't just for me. My problems were a lot of other people's problems as well. And they used AG Grid and they said, hey, Niall, this grid, it's really good. You should consider developing this more, trying to get more people interested in it. So I spent a year still working my day job, building AG Grid in the evenings and weekends. And then at the end of that year, there was enough energy around it where I thought, you know what, I'm going to quit my job and see if I can, you know, make a living out of AG Grid full time. But looking back over the last couple of years, like AG Grid, as we said at the start, it has been really successful. It's got like, you know, millions of downloads. There's a huge community around it. And I used to ask myself, like, how did that happen? How did I manage to pull something off? Because a data grid is a problem that people have tried many, 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 many times before.
Oh, yeah.
But for some reason, AG Grid happened to do it in a way that caught the imagination of a lot of people. And I began to question how. What was it specific about the choices that I made in the project to get to where we are today? And that's where I realized there was a journey from what was a small open source project to a very large complex system with different designs inside of it, which has allowed us to manage the complexity of building a data grid. And then just to throw in here as well, in case people don't know, AG Grid has zero dependencies. It works with all the frameworks, but internally, we don't depend on any of the frameworks or underscore or jQuery or any of that. So the problem that AG Grid solved is, how did we manage to build this complex system without using any frameworks or any other libraries?
So that was one of the problems, was how to do that. Was this all primarily because you wanted to keep the payload size small? I mean, key criteria for you that you had to be able to do? Because there are tons of grids out there that have filtering and grouping and all that other stuff. Now, whether they do it as well as or in the way that you need it is a different question. But what is, like, if you had five things that this had to do, what would they be?
Interesting question. Five things.
Three things. What were the three things that this had?
One thing that it could do.
One thing.
Is there anything it does?
No, it needed to be without a framework. Look, I remember because I know one of the competitors at the time that you were doing this relied on jQuery, which means you had to buy into jQuery to get it. And it was like 10 megabytes. I'm exaggerating perhaps, but it felt like 10 megabytes.
Or 10 gigs, something like that.
Yeah, just to, no, yeah, it was gigantic. And so I, you know, when in my own search for data grids, I have been looking for something that was small and that didn't depend on a third-party library, all right? So those were criteria for me. Apparently, those were criteria for you, but what else?
Yeah, so I think the three things to start with were fast features and it had to work. And that wasn't available in the other grids. So theater grids could either be really, really fast, like SlickGrid, but it wouldn't have a bunch of features. Or it was other grids whose names won't mention because they're backed by companies who they would have all the features, but then when you put lots of data into them, they wouldn't work very fast. So there was a gap there to get one that solved all three. So that was fast features and actually worked. And then the fourth one I'll throw in as well, although because I can't count now to three means four, that appealed to developers, people like me who were Java people or C-sharp people coming to the JavaScript world. Because about 5 years ago, most people in the JavaScript community were coming at it from being web developers. And they liked their HTML and PHP and had design minds. But me as a Java developer, I wasn't a graphical person. I wasn't into HTML. I was into Java code. So I wanted a grid or a web component that was presented to me with an interface that was a programmer's interface rather than a web interface with tags or jQuery DOM elements.
Now, what one of the things that always comes up, you'll hear these days, and not as much as, say, when did you start this again? Was it about 5 years ago, did you say?
Yeah, started 2015.
Well, definitely 5 years ago you'd hear this was, okay, so I'm going to move to, let's just call it vanilla JavaScript, right, type of approach. But now I'm going to have all these cross-browser issues. So how did you deal with some of that? Did you have to, for instance, use a lot of polyfills or just do your own thing?
Yeah, that was interesting because back then, about 5 years ago, that was a fear. And most people would at least depend on jQuery. And what I think people didn't realize is that the browsers had advanced a lot by then. And people are using jQuery thinking they were benefiting from a polyfill when actually they weren't. Like one simple example is the query selectors, that if you wanted to find a DOM element, people who use jQuery would default into using the query selector method provided by jQuery. But at the time, the browsers had the document query selector built in that worked just as well. And that's what we used. So I went through this path of discovery where I found that most of the things that people were depending on jQuery for was not necessary.
Hey, note to everybody, I think that's true. You know, I see so many people building jQuery in and just to use it to select DOM elements. You don't have to do that.
Exactly. And I think the same possibly for the frameworks as well, because you have people who are Angular developers and they know Angular very well. But if you take Angular away, they don't know much about DOM or about HTML. So when we started doing AG Grid, I was working with AngularJS at the time. That's what was being used in my job. And I wanted a grid that would work really fast with AngularJS. So I started doing some prototyping. And I created a version of AG Grid that was pure AngularJS. I created a version of AG Grid that was using Canvas. I created another version which was pure JavaScript. And I also created a version then that was like a hybrid between JavaScript and AngularJS. The Canvas one is interesting, because it worked really fast, but I had to discount that because it would have been really difficult to customize. You would be adding Canvas to your stack in an application, and we didn't want to do that. That would push people away. So I was kind of left with the Angular hybrid. The AngularJS one was just too slow. It just didn't really do what I needed it to do. I found that a data grid has a different type of requirements than an application would have. So if you look at what the frameworks provide, where you've got data binding on forms and, say, routing, those are application concerns. They're not data grid concerns. A data grid is concerned with getting lots of cells into a small space and scrolling up and down and left and right and then filtering and manipulation that way. So all of the power with a framework doesn't really fit when you're trying to build a data grid.
Go ahead. I was going to say, I love real quick how you actually tried all those different things. You don't see that much these days. You know, people jump into the way that they think is going to be best. And you actually tried, I mean, gosh, you named like five different ways, I think you tried.
Yeah, well, see, I was curious. I was really curious. And back then, this was a pet project. It was a hobby. I wanted to know. I'd been using Angular for about 2 years. I'd never really given the DOM the time that I should have given it to understand what's behind Angular when you lift it up. And this is actually over Christmas. It was 2 weeks back at my parents' house. And I was just really, really, really curious. So I started banging these prototypes out to see where they'd go.
So I'm reminded by what you're saying that in sort of normal forms develop it. You know, let's say I have as many, I never do. I never have more than 1,000 data, you know, binding points, data values that have to appear and possibly can change on the screen in normal stuff. I rarely have more than 50, but if I'm talking about any kind of grid here, and particularly in your industry, in the financial industry, they just love lots of columns and lots of rows. There's no way I'm going to use a framework to manage all of that data.
Exactly. And what they do is developers, and we target developers. Developers are the consumer of AG Grid. It's not end users, although they do end up using it in their applications. And what a developer will do is they'll go to our website, they'll go to our AG Grid demo, they'll put in 10,000 rows, and then they'll get their mouse or their on the scroll bar, and they'll drag it down to the end on the vertical scroll and see if the grid can actually scroll really, really, really fast.
I've actually done that. I have done that exact thing. So
why? Users don't do that. But that's the test of a good grid. That's what people do. How fast can you rip through lots and lots and lots of rows? And as you're doing that, like, I don't know if you're aware, but one of the things a data grid must do, like it's kind of like entry level, is row virtualization. And that means only rendering into the DOM the rows that you can see with inside the scrollable viewport. So if you've got 10,000 rows, but you can only see 25 on the screen, then only 25 rows will be inserted into the DOM. And then as you scroll down, the DOM is ripping the rows out of the DOM and then inserting new rows as you're scrolling down. So there is a kind of a batch operation that you have to do to get those rows into the grid as fast as possible as the user is scrolling down to give a smooth scrolling experience. And that's the, like when we talk about performance in a grid, that's the test. And that's what people like to see work really fast.
Well, and to share a story with you, so Social Security Administration here in the U.S., I had a particular person who was just asking about, grids in general. In fact, they were looking at building their own. And then, of course, they hit the standard challenges because they were using all the framework-y features. You know, it doesn't really matter what the framework is, but they were using those features. No virtualization like you're talking about. So we actually tried that, yours, and that's where I actually first did exactly what you said, where I, you know, put in like 100,000 rows. You would never do that, I hope. And then scroll to the very bottom, and he was just like, oh, my gosh, like, that's amazing. And, you know, like you said, it doesn't matter if it's vanilla JavaScript or framework. Without that virtualization, it's just not possible, you know, with if you put everything in the DOM. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to interject another pro tip. One of the things that and I think John and Dan, we've all tried to coax our customers when they're doing UX. Please, please don't use a grid as your primary UX. It just drives, especially for naive users, it drives them crazy. But because so many of the times our clients are, our enterprise clients who have existing systems that have that have grids in them anyway, and they have users who are not naive or users, but actually ones who are used to wandering around in intense, data-intensive pages, we keep getting driven back to them. So it isn't my favorite user interface, but if you've got one of those, then Data Grid you must. And I guess that's where you found yourself in your financial, at your investment bank?
Absolutely. And you're correct. There's a category of users that love grids. And if you're working in one of the investment banks, like nearly all the applications have a Data Grid in it. It's almost like a must. But then there's a whole bigger group of people who never use grids and who possibly disliked them because it's against the desired UX.
Speaking of business problems, we have a business problem, or rather we have a business challenge, which is we got to keep the lights on. And what do we do that? We have sponsors. Hi, folks. Ward Bell here. I'd like to tell you about a wonderful tech conference coming up in Las Vegas in November, Dev Intersection. Dev Intersection is for web application developers, especially those of you working at the intersection of Microsoft and Angular technologies. John, Dan, and I will be speaking there. So are a lot of bright, thoughtful, and really friendly speakers who know their stuff and who really want to meet you. The talks are great. The workshops are killer. John and Dan have a great workshop on Angular. But the conversations you'll have in the hallways, lunchroom, and after-hours events with speakers and fellow attendees, Those conversations are gold. They're why you need to go to a conference and not just watch one on TV. So join us at Dev Intersection, November 18th through 20th in Las Vegas, Nevada. Learn more and register at www.devintersection.com. And if you register with my code, BELL, B-E-L-L, you could get a discount. See you there. And we're back. We're back with Niall Crosby, who's telling us about building complex software that interacts performantly with the DOM.
So going back real quick, Niall, to when you first started this, I'm kind of curious. So did you start out virtualizing everything first off across all those prototypes you did?
Oh, yes. It had to be done. That was one of the things that the prototype had to prove it was able to do.
Cool. What were some of the key things you discovered as far as, because I'm sure you've run into several, let's just call them kind of like Ward just said, tips and tricks type things that you were like, wow, if you do this, it's a massive performance boost over, you know, option B, whatever that is. Was there anything that stands out aside from the virtualization?
Yeah. Like when I did the first version, that was just vanilla virtualization. There wasn't much to it. And I brought it into work and it worked really, really well. But one of the problems when you provide a framework like this to other developers to build apps is you're exposed to every deployment environment possible. So it was good enough for me, but I had users who were working in banks, they were using IE, not Chrome, and were using low-powered machines or virtual machines. So I had to continuously go back and make it faster. So in AG Grid, what we've kind of done is, over the past few years, evolutionary prototyping is what I like to call it. So where we'll come up with a version, it'll be good enough, and then we have to come back to it because we have to make it good enough again and just keep putting things into it. So row virtualization is a must. And then column virtualization was another one we had to add. And column virtualization is actually more difficult because with columns, there's more use cases a column has to fit because you can have column groups. Then you have columns that are hidden where you kind of expand a group to show more columns or more data about something. You've also got columns in pinned areas left and right where the center scrolls but the pinned left and the pinned right doesn't. And you've also got moving columns where you drag with your mouse and move columns around. So there's a lot of complexities there. But then to get the scrolling really fast, as I was saying, that's kind of one of the test cases developers have for a data grid. We also added in debouncing the scroll, which is, I guess, would sound familiar to most listeners. Debouncing is you listen to the event and then you act on the event in a different VM turn. And that gave it a smooth experience where at least the scroll bar wasn't hugging as you dragged it down, but there was still a delay then in the redraw, which is happening in the background. Then the next thing we did is we started using animation frames and also a custom task queue. So animation frames is where you can delegate pieces of the work to different animation frames to the browser. So the ideal, I think, is it'll execute one animation frame every 1/60th of a second so that you're getting a refresh every 60. So you're getting 60 refreshes every second to keep up with the refresh rate of your screen. But what we found is if you're splitting your... at a point, you can take out my hums and haws starting again. So what we found is with our naive implementation of using animation frames, we would pick up all the work blocks and we would, like a work block would be a piece of work that had to be done to render, for example, build a cell. And if we delegated each work block to one animation frame, they weren't working quick enough because there was more than 60 work blocks in every second. So what we did is we created a task queue and as these work blocks are getting created, they'd be put onto the task queue. And then we would have in a different thread, the animation frame thread, every time that would wake up, it would take work items off this task queue and execute as many as it can within 1/60th of a second. And then when it was finished, it would go back to sleep and then come online again and execute another batch until the task queue was exhausted. And this...
Do you have some way of sort of guaranteeing that each block takes
we assume that the blocks execute in less than 1/60th of a second, which is correct in the tests that we did. If the block is taking longer to execute, then we will get degradation in performance. But that hasn't been raised.
Oh, I was just wondering if you how you I was imagining that what you did is you would score each different kind of operation in terms of the amount of time it consumed, and then you would perform as many of those blocks as possible.
Very interesting. We did something similar but completely different. We scored them at how important they were. Yeah. So the ones with the highest importance are the ones that are drawing the backgrounds of the rows. So grids will normally have a zebra effect where every second row will be a different color. So as you're scrolling down, we would draw the backgrounds first. So you would see this striped pattern move quickest as you're scrolling up and down. Then the second one that we did is about how like the fastest way to update the DOM. And this is where we went through another set of tests where what is the quickest way to update the DOM? Is it by accessing the DOM directly, where you insert elements one by one? Do you build the elements up outside the DOM first and then attach them all at the end? Do you create a bunch of HTML in a string and then use inner HTML? Do you use document fragments? Do you try and reuse DOM elements? So as a row is no longer needed, you would update the cell contents and use it again as a different row. So all of those things were tested. And they gave varying answers dependent on which browser you were in. So what we ended up doing was giving precedence to the results of IE and Chrome. Because in our experience, everybody tries to use Chrome if they can. And if they can't, it's probably because you're being forced to use IE, because a lot of banks will be standardizing on the browser that comes with Windows. And we found that between those two, using inner HTML was the fastest way to do a batch insert into the DOM. So what we do for each row is we calculate the row's contents as a string, and then we set the inner HTML for that row DOM element to get the fastest insert. So going back to our task queue, the first thing we do is we draw the backgrounds of the rows, and then the second thing we do is we inject the HTML into that row to give it its content. Then the third thing that we do is not all the cells can be converted into HTML, which is what happens if you're using a custom component the user provided, because they could be using Angular or React or one of our components because we got our own library as well. If we're using one of those components, then we attach that DOM element to that component as the third thing. And then lastly, we destroy the old rows, because you can't see that happening. It doesn't matter when that happens.
That's pretty cool. So you got it down to a science, which is why it's so fast. You've had a lot of experience. I know this, Ward. Anytime I ever have a question on, hey, what should I use? You know, document fragment, inner HTML. We know who to call.
So. Well, I've had 5 years of daydreaming about this stuff. It's been my life for 5 years.
Let's take a quick break from a word from our sponsor.
Are you building a web application? Need to deliver it soon and don't have the people to do it? Maybe you're not sure your company has the skill set or experience to do it. And maybe we can help. I'm your host, Ward Bell, and my day job is building applications for companies like yours. I don't do it alone. I'm president of IdeaBlade, a consultancy that specializes in enterprise web application development. We're particularly strong in Angular, RxJS, NGRX Redux on the front end, and .NET and Microsoft technologies on the server. We're a small, tight-knit group of people handpicked by me for their expertise, experience, integrity, and team spirit. Maybe we can help you with architectural guidance and hands-on development. And if there's something we don't know, and in our field, really, there's too much to know, we can draw on our personal connections in the Microsoft RD, MVP, and Google GDE networks, as well as our international circle of really great developers, people we know and trust personally. If you got a project that's keeping you up at night, shoot us an email at info@ideablade.com. That's info@ideablade.com. And now back to the show.
And we're back. So, Niall, we've been talking quite a bit about how you kind of came about this idea, how it evolved, kind of out of, not, I'm saying nowhere, but like an idea in your head to implementation and people using this whole thing. But part of the story I'm really curious on here, and I imagine our listeners are too, is if you build something like this, and you started alluding to this a moment ago with Ward, if you build something like this, there's a lot that goes along with it. Like, it's not just, oh, you know what? Nothing does exactly what I want. I'll just go build one. There's a lot of support and maintenance and a lot of things that go along with this. So do you regret it? Are you happy with it? Would you do it again?
Oh, this is the last piece of software I'm ever going to write. so probably no. But do you mean from a lifestyle point of view, or are you talking about the technical challenges point of view?
I'd be interested in hearing both, actually.
And you know, you build a something of a company around it, and yet it's open source. So how, you know, that decision alone opens up a set of questions, both about lifestyle and product.
Yeah.
So tell us any of these things.
Well, this wasn't part of the plan. When I gave up my job, I knew, okay, I'm going to work in AG Grid. But honestly, I thought I was going to be a consultant, or maybe I'd have one or two guys working for me. I didn't appreciate how big this thing was going to get. I say this is probably the last big piece of software I'd ever write, because why would I give this up? Like, I'm the CEO and CTO of a company that I really, really love. And I am passionate about AG Grid and the code base, and just seeing what it can do. I'm so proud of the team and what we're achieving. Why would I leave this and go work on something else? So I hope for the moment AG Grid sees me out. In terms of the challenges, like, I've learned a lot in building AG Grid, and being able to do something from scratch as a pet project. The kind of interesting thing here is I broke all the rules at the start. I didn't use a framework. You would not be allowed to do that if you're working in a company. I didn't have test cases. Again, you wouldn't be allowed to do that if you worked in a company. I just used JavaScript as opposed to TypeScript, even though I'm from a strongly typed background. And because I had this minimalistic approach to programming the first versions of AG Grid, I then began to feel the pain of, this is why you use an IOC container, or this is why it's good to have some kind of framework in place. So I had to feel the pain of missing these things. And then I went through the challenge of bringing those things into AG Grid and getting them to solve my pain. So it really hammered into me why we have all these different types of programming practices. Like, I'll give you an example of one, which was the IOC container. So,
oh, thank you. Because just, you made my heart sing when you did that, because so many people who don't have one sort of say, yeah, what do you need that for? That's just Java and C Sharp. I don't need an IOC container. So I want to hear why you suffered without it. And what, because there's so many people in some of these other frameworks, they can't see the point. So
let me give you the textbook answer, and then I'll give you my answer, okay? The textbook answer is, it's more difficult to do unit tests if you don't have an IOC container. Because if you don't have an IOC container, then you've got hard references into the dependencies of your object. And then it's more difficult to instantiate your object and put in mocks for these dependencies so that you can do testing in isolation. With an IOC container, it should be possible to provide mocks when you're testing a particular object. So that's why IOC containers became popular back in the day, back in Java when Spring came around. It was about the move towards testing. But that wasn't my reason for moving to an IOC container. So the first few versions of AG Grid, and you can check this out from our GitHub project, go to version 4-. And if you've got a complex piece of software, where you've got N levels of dependencies between what we call services, I guess, what you end up doing is having a constructor with lots of references coming into the constructor. And then it would store all these references locally. But not only do you need all of the references that your service is going to need, you're going to need all the services that all the services you're going to create is going to need. So you end up with these chains of references being passed around all over your application. And it gets very daunting. So it's sugar code, and it's bad. It's a bad pattern to have lots of sugar code in your application. If the code isn't contributing towards the business problem that you're trying to solve, then that's a smell, and you should somehow try to abstract that away. So,
but what if I like my sugar code? What if it tastes really good?
See, the,
that's right.
Sugar, you got diabetes, John.
I'm being funny about it, or trying to be, but I guess what I'm trying to get at is there's a lot of times I think as developers, and I do this myself, we write code and it is sugar code if somebody objectively looks at it, but maybe when you're looking at it, you don't necessarily know, like you don't pick up on it, that it's not necessarily the code that's needed.
Yeah, I think a lot of developers are like that. And I think what most developers need to understand is the most important thing to do when you're writing code is to make your code maintainable.
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
That's
boy,
it.
Ward, I know, will chime in on that too. Maintenance is where it's at.
Yeah, absolutely. And then one people don't like to hear, it's cheap. It's got to cost less to deliver. So you want it to cost less and be very maintainable. And I don't mean you get cheap programmers when I say that. You get expensive programmers, but they must see their time as a resource that's got an expense element to it. So when I write code, I'm always trying to get it down to the, you know, KISS principles, keep it simple, stupid, and have it so that it can be then handed over to somebody else and they will have a really easy time maintaining that code into the future.
So there are three things I want to pull out of what you've just said. See if I can remember what they are in order. First, everybody says it's about testing, but since nobody writes tests, that's not an effective reason to use IOC. Everybody should write tests. Everybody knows they should, but you won't find anybody who's willing to architect a system simply to make it testable. So that one comes out. The second thing you drew that really struck for me is that this dependency injection is a creational pattern that addresses most people think of it as, oh, well, you know, I'll just new up something or I'll rely on something being newed up and I don't know how it's configured. But in fact, it's about just-in-time creation and having the consumer not know how that thing was constructed or when it was constructed or anything like that. It's just like given.
And Ward, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. Since you're talking about dependency injection and we talked about IOC, can you kind of just draw the correlation between those two for everybody?
Yes. Dependency injection is the pattern by which the dependencies that you need when your class needs something, an apparatus, you simply declare that you need the thing and the apparatus around that implements dependency injection gives it to you. So if I need a service or I need three services, I announce that fact as the author of the class that I'm going to need these three things. I hope somebody's out there is going to give them to me, typically in a constructor. And then the apparatus outside makes sure that your class's instances are constructed with those dependencies. So that's dependency injection. IOC, or inversion of control, forget what that means, container, is the place where the apparatus, the dependency injection apparatus, holds instances of the dependencies that you want. So again, if I'm the consuming class and I want the X service, then the apparatus looks, just says, do I have an X? No, I don't. I'll create one. I'll stick it in the IOC. I'll stick it in the container. And it knew whether it had anything. The next time somebody wants the X, it goes and says, I look in the container. There's an X. Now I've got it. So IOC, the container is an implementation of a dependency injection framework. That's how I explain it.
That sums it up.
Would you agree with that, Niall?
Yeah, I'd agree. I would say that dependency injection is a feature of an IOC container.
Well, in any event, that's how they go together. You gotta have a place for all these things that you created, and the container is the place, and it usually has recipes for this, which is what we often mean when we say we provide the X service. What we're really doing is we're providing a recipe so that the dependency and framework thing can say, oh, I don't have an X. Here's how I create an X.
Right, so kind of closing us back to how it helped AG Grid. So I'm from a Java background. I had done Spring before. We stole the pattern from Spring. So we have an auto-wired annotation, which is if we have a service that depends on another service, we just stick an annotation before the attribute where we say auto-wired and then the service name. And your IOC container will automatically wire the service up for us. So By implementing that, it greatly reduced the complexity of our code. And then a term that I like calling is brain energy. It frees up brain energy. So as we're writing code and maintaining code, our brain energy is not being consumed by managing these references. It's simplified, therefore freeing up our brain energy to work on the problems that we should be focused on. So that was the benefit.
Which in practical terms, mean that my consuming class isn't spending time figuring out how to create or you know, find these services and create them or worry about them. It just doesn't. It just says, give it to me.
Exactly.
And that frees your consuming class up to focus on whatever the heck it's supposed to do instead of how it's supposed to manage its dependencies. And I don't know how people live without that.
Sometimes I think it's you don't know what you don't know. Now, you live through it. Now, you came from the Java background, so I guess it's a little different. You knew about it. So real quick, you added the annotation slash decorator, same type of thing. Is that what you mean by?
Yeah, auto-wired. Yeah.
And then you wrote a little IOC kind of logic into all that, and then that just automatically injects what you need, it sounds like.
Yeah, and if anybody wants to do the same, again, AgeGrid's open source, steal.
I think the third thing is that this is not a heavyweight business, right? This is not, some people think that you have to have a wildly complicated dependency injection framework. And I suspect that you have a pretty little.
Correct. It's very lightweight. It's very lightweight. And I like that because there's more to our framework as well. We have our, there's two main parts. There's the IOC container, and then we've also got our own component framework, which is just as simple. And I like being able to debug through the framework code and understand exactly how it works. Something I don't really love about the likes of Angular and React is that the code is complicated and they have these like black boxes of magic of what happens to my data as it travels from my service all the way to the DOM. And you can't debug through it. And it's a science. Or sorry, it's a black magic art. What we have is something that's simple that works for us. Why would we want to make it any more complicated?
Hey, now, thanks for coming on here. And at the end of our show, we like to toss out like a final tip for everybody about the topic. Can be related to the topic we have, or just a general tip in general for our listeners. I'd like to start with Ward. What is yours?
Well, I opened with it. It's all about the Grand Canyon, friends. Go there. There are a number of companies. And I'm sure they're all great. I will just say that the one I used was Grand Canyon Expeditions, and I got a link in there. And if you can find a way to put some family and friends together, give yourself a treat and go float down the Colorado.
Awesome. Dan, what is your tip?
Well, I'm going to tie back into, because I think we're all kind of guilty of this. How many times have you sat in a meeting and you or somebody says, oh, well, you should do it this way because it's way faster. But how many times have you actually validated that? And, you know, I think, Niall, the whole thing you just talked about this whole 45 minutes or so here is you validated just about everything. And I don't know if it's still out there, but I know there's other sites, but it used to be, I think it was JS Perf or something like that was a website. I have no idea if that's still going. But there are sites out there where you can go prove these things. And so I guess my tip would be before you just trust what someone says, because, you know, keep in mind, they might have read it on the internet, although we know that's all true if it came from there. But, you know, joking aside, I think there is some benefits, I guess, to maybe question what's considered best and go try it for yourself.
Awesome. And Niall, do you have any tips for us?
My tip is I think every JavaScript developer should try and write a small app with zero dependencies just for fun. Because if you do that, you will learn a hell of a lot about what browsers are capable of, and you'll also really appreciate what the libraries do that you're using.
That's a really good tip, and it goes along with mine as well, which is getting back to some of the basics. I think we've all learned HTML, CSS, and JavaScript at different paces and different places, and we probably all have our own gaps and strengths there. I think it's really good to occasionally look back and go, you know, let me go back and look at the HTML spec, or let me go back and relearn some CSS, HTML, and JavaScript itself, just to see what is capable and what we can do, both in the browser or server side with Node if you're talking JavaScript. So it's really good to get back to the basics and not rely so much on the frameworks all the time. And it actually makes you a better programmer with the frameworks when you know exactly what the languages can do. So with that, thank you again, Niall, for coming on and talking to us about your journey through creating HE Grid, and thanks for creating it for all of us to use.
You're welcome, guys, and thanks for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yes, it's been great. And for all of you, thank you for listening to yet another week of Real Talk JavaScript. We'll see you, or you'll hear from us, every Tuesday morning. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk JavaScript. This show and all of our shows are available at www.realtalkjs.com with links and notes. John and Ward would love to hear what you think, especially about potential guests and topics for future shows. Follow and send them a message on Twitter at RealTalkJS.